Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We should have sunny skies for the rest of this afternoon around the valley, looking for a high temperature of 91. Clear skies tonight with lows in the mid to upper 60s, and then sunny tomorrow with a high of 90. Currently with relative humidity at 10%, sunny skies and 86 degrees. More than a year after a settlement was approved, the federal judge involved in Parsons v. Ryan has found that prisoners in the state still are not getting acceptable health care. At the one-year mark, the Department of Corrections was supposed to be at 75% compliance with the agreement, which involved more than 100 health care performance measures. But a number of prisons are not reaching that level. To learn more about prison health care, I'm joined by Donna Leone Hamm, founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, an advocacy organization. Donna, how did you feel initially more than a year ago when the judge announced the settlement? And then how does it make you feel now that it looks like limited progress has been made?
The monitoring is in effect for 3 years, and the first year they only had to meet 75% of the performance requires, the next year 80%, and the final year only 85%. So they're never expected to be perfect. The settlement also included a provision that whenever the lawyers who were monitoring the settlement wanted to go into the prison to perform an inspection, they had to give a two-week notice. However, even with those sort of low standards for the department to meet, they are still falling far below on their compliance with performance measures, especially in the area of mental health care, timely refills of medication prescriptions, obtaining care for serious medical illnesses without delays.
Is Arizona much worse than other states, or is this something we're seeing fairly consistently across the nation?
Well, there's no prison, either state or federal, where they are famous for their wonderful medical care. I can certainly tell you that. And none of them aspire to be the Mayo Clinic. They know that they have a certain basic minimum constitutional obligation to provide medical care to prisoners for their basic serious medical needs. But none of them aspire to go beyond that, and frankly, they don't. In the case of Arizona, it's just getting them to meet their basic minimum standards. And frankly, they privatized the medical care several years ago. And we thought that it might be a chance for them to significantly improve the offerings and the quality of medical care, because for the first time, they had a contract with a private company that they could enforce. But what has happened with both of the private providers is they keep going to the Department of Corrections and saying, we can't live up to our obligations because you're not giving us enough money. We need to modify our contract. We need to hire more people.
I want to ask you a little bit more about behavioral health, mental health care. What are some steps that you think, even from a practical standpoint, could be taken to improve that aspect of care if people were committed to providing it?
Well, I mean, the first thing and the biggest thing and probably the most obvious thing, but the least likely to occur, is that we would find a way to not send so many mentally ill people to prison. But assuming we still continue to send people to prison, they need to have separate, specialized, and highly professionalized mental health units where people can go and expect that if the judge recommended at the time of sentencing that they were to receive some sort of specialized or individualized mental health care, that they would actually get it.
So, Donna, when we consider that now we're a little bit more than 1 year after the settlement and there's nowhere near 75% in compliance, what makes the next step happen?
The department has been given a certain amount of time, a brief amount of time, about a month, to come up with a plan for how they intend to rectify the deficiencies that have now been acknowledged by the court. And if they don't come up with a plan or they don't succeed in completing those requirements, those compliance measures, there are sanctions, civil penalties and so forth, contempt proceedings that the court can conduct, which end up possibly fining the Department of Corrections, which I think would at least then begin to get the notice of the legislature.
Donna Leon Hamm is Executive Director of Middle Ground Prison Reform. By strict definition of the word, drought means a prolonged absence of something. And here in the Southwest, the drought we're most focused on has to do with a lack of rainfall or limited snowpack. And that drought continues to extend, and its impact is being felt in Lake Mead. The Colorado River Reservoir has shrunk to its lowest levels since the completion of Hoover Dam in 1936. The lake is only 37% full. With me to talk about what that could mean for Arizona and what some western states are planning to do is Dave White, director of the Decision Center for a Desert City at ASU. And Dave, let's start with just the basics. Why is Lake Mead so important to the water supply in this area?
Well, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, the two major reservoirs that provide storage for the water for the southwestern United States, are critical to create a buffer against drought and to provide resilience to the system so that we can store up to 5 years of the demand of water that we have in those reservoirs and deliver that water consistently, even during times of low inflow into the system.
So when we hear that Mead has shrunk to its lowest levels in about 80 years and the lake's only 37% full, that sounds alarming to some of us. How big a deal is this actually?
This is a very significant challenge, and it's a signal of several factors. One is the ongoing drought, which has affected the region for approximately 15 years. And the second is the impact of climate change, which is leading to warmer temperatures and very likely decreased surface water supplies into the Colorado River system. So these two factors, along with demand that is increasing, particularly in the municipal sector in the lower Colorado River Basin, are putting exceeding stress and pressure on our ability to be able to supply water sustainably to the region.
How much can engineering and or conserving do about this situation, and how much is simply worth the mercy of nature to some extent?
Well, certainly there are many solutions that we can apply right now that rely both on engineering but also on behavioral measures. So one of the most promising is the Colorado River System Conservation Pilot Program. This program has been funded by a cooperation of the Central Arizona Project, the Bureau of Reclamation, the Southern Nevada Water Authority, and the Los Angeles Area Water Authority to be able to provide funds to conserve water and retain that water into the reservoirs. And so those are through projects that look at agricultural irrigation efficiencies and other efficiencies. So it's a demand management approach that doesn't focus on building new infrastructure or engineering, but focuses on conserving water in the lower basin and in the upper basin and maintaining that water in the reservoirs. These kinds of programs are increasingly important.
Dave, when it comes to something like this, which really has to have short-term thinking, but also that long-term thinking, that forethought and actually having some ideas into the future. What's the ideal balance there, in your opinion, as far as knowing that? Because again, when we hear about possibilities of a shortage in 2017 or 2018, so we have to think about that. And yet we, in order to make sure the region is viable and sustainable for many, many decades, you have to think in other terms, right?
Right, absolutely. And one of the things that's going on right now in the short term are the leaders from the states of California, Nevada, and Arizona are in broad discussions to be able to plan for and, in fact, enact voluntary curtailments on the water supplies coming out of the Central Arizona Project to be able to forestall the potential of a declaration by the Secretary of Interior of an official shortage on the river system. And so, again, these are short-term initiatives that are being led by the states that are proactive, as instead of waiting for the Department of Interior to declare a shortage. Meanwhile, we must have teams of people that are working on the long-term planning to deal with what we call the structural imbalance. Essentially, the demand that is exceeding our projected supply over the coming decades. And so we have to have leaders working on the short-term solution while simultaneously we're dealing with this structural problem in the basin.
Dave White is director of the Decision Center for a Desert City at ASU. Dave, thank you as always.
Thank you, Steve. Good to talk to you.
It's the show for Monday. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry.
The complicated relationship between the U.S. and Vietnam seems to be getting simpler.
This change will ensure that Vietnam has access to the equipment it needs to defend itself and removes a lingering vestige of the Cold War.
President Obama in Ho Chi Minh City announcing the end of a decades-long arms embargo on Vietnam, moving it from former enemy to potential arms customer of the U.S. President Obama is now the third sitting president to visit this Cold War adversary since President Bill Clinton visited in 2000. With me now to discuss this not-so-complicated relationship is Edward Miller. He's the author of Misalliance, No Din Gem, the U.S. and the Fate of South Vietnam, and a professor of history at Dartmouth College. He says visiting Vietnam seems to have become a 21st century tradition of U.S. presidents.
The U.S. normalized its ties with Vietnam 20 years ago in 1995. And since then, the relationship has really grown by leaps and bounds. And when you go to Vietnam today, when you talk to officials in both governments, they really make it clear that this is a warm relationship and it's a high priority for both of them. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the reasons has to do with the shared concerns about China, especially China's aggressive moves in the South China Sea in recent years. I think there's also, though, a lot of focus on trade. Trade is booming between the United States and Vietnam. It hit more than $30 billion last year. Also, a fair amount of American foreign investment in Vietnam. And then I think there's also the issue of the memory of the war and reconciliation between the United States and Vietnam. There's so many ways in which the relationship has expanded in the last 20 years, not just in terms of trade, but in terms of cultural connections, in terms of educational exchange. There are more than 10,000 Vietnamese students studying in the United States. So this is really a warm and vibrant relationship.
In the region, you've got Taiwan, China, interesting challenges in the South China Sea that seem to be confronting the Philippines. Where does Vietnam fit into all that, or is it in some ways insulated from all that and that the U.S. goes to visit Vietnam to get away from those confrontations?
Vietnam is not at all insulated from the conflicts in the South China Sea. Vietnam is actually one of the major players or contestants that's involved in the ongoing disputes over the South China Sea. Like China, Vietnam claims sovereignty over a huge portion of the South China Sea. And of all the various claimants, Vietnam and China are the ones that are in most direct conflict and direct confrontation. Vietnam claims sovereignty over both of the major island chains in the South China Sea, the Paracels and the Spratlys, as China does. The other countries in the region claim pieces of those chains, but Vietnam, along with China, is really one of the central actors.
What do you make of this embargo, you know, dropping this embargo that President Obama did today? Is it a significant move forward or just a symbolic gesture? And does the U.S. have influence on human rights issues in Vietnam?
Well, let me take the issue of the arms embargo first. It's more than just a symbolic gesture. I think on the one hand, it is something that the Vietnamese government has been seeking for a long time. And so in that sense, it's something that Obama can offer that the Vietnamese government really wants. From the United States standpoint, I think this is clearly being undertaken with an eye on China and with the escalating tensions in the South China Sea. However, I do think that this could have a potential impact going forward. Vietnam still buys the majority of its military hardware from Russia, and that's a direct legacy of the Cold War when Vietnam was in the orbit of the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 1980s. Potentially, this could change it. This could lead over the long run to closer U.S.-Vietnam military relations. On the question of human rights, the United States certainly has influence with this, and I think that U.S. diplomats, the U.S. mission in Vietnam, spends a lot of time talking to their Vietnamese counterparts about human rights, and actually not just talking. U.S. diplomats in Vietnam routinely make a point of visiting opposition figures who have been targeted by the regime for their views on democracy and on other human rights questions. So this is an important aspect of U.S.-Vietnam relations. It's clearly not the most important aspect. I think the economic and the security considerations take precedence over human rights, but it's definitely a key part of the relationship.
Edward Miller is professor of history at Dartmouth College, author of Miss Alliance, No Dinh Diem, the U.S. and the Fate of South Vietnam. He's also the founder of the Dartmouth Vietnam Project.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. And during his remarks in Vietnam, President Obama also dropped the name of an Arizona institution.
American academic and technological leaders, including Intel, Oracle, Arizona State University, and others, will help Vietnamese universities boost training in science, technology, engineering, and math.
The president is referring to a program through ASU called the Higher Engineering Education Alliance Program. For the past 6 years, the program has been training Vietnamese professors and faculty in new ways to teach engineering. A new cohort of professors from Vietnam started the newest session of the program at ASU today. Refugees face dramatic challenges as they're forced to leave their home countries and land in unfamiliar places that may or may not be welcoming. Immigrants who choose to move to a new nation often have had time to consider when to go and why. Some who come to the U.S. may even have friends or relatives to help them get settled, but that doesn't mean the transition is easy and without obstacles. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a woman who moved to Arizona from Moldova with her family. We start with Sandra Matar, primary supervisor at the Center for Multicultural Training at Boston Medical Center. Sandra, there have been headlines related to the current presidential campaign that feature one candidate in particular who has said unfavorable things about some immigrants. Is that the kind of thing that may cause hesitation in someone who's considering relocating to the U.S.?
I don't think that that's the first thing that they consider. I think that it's opportunity, the economic opportunity and education for their kids, moving faster in the socioeconomic ladder. That's what they're looking for. And many of them would simply minimize any knowledge or previous knowledge that they have about the country. Once they get here, that's when they start receiving the treatment. That's when they might get confused. There's some sort of culture shock. And we see that a lot of in international students, that there's an actual syndrome called culture shock, where they don't understand the way they're being treated. They don't understand how their behavior is impacting how they are being treated. And suddenly they get confused because they don't know if it's something that they're doing wrong or is it the treatment that they're receiving. But they want to give the benefit of the doubt, obviously, and it's very confusing. It's extremely, extremely disconcerting. In many of these immigrants, they come from they are the majority in the countries they come from. So, and in this case, I'm talking about people of color. When they come to the U.S., they get very confused as to the treatment they receive because they have never received that, or the treatment has not been so blatantly racist or different. So there's two factors here. One is the race. The other one is the fact of being an immigrant.
So how vital is it that when an immigrant comes to the U.S., that he or she, or if there's a family, if there is some connection to either a friend of a family friend, or that they gather with people who are of a similar culture, whether it's at a community center or a particular neighborhood? How important is that to the adjustment?
People tend to say, the general comment out there is, they all live together, or they all love to live in the same neighborhoods. Well, the reason is, and psychological research proves, that when people do that, they are protected. It's a protective factor to their mental health, because they find people that look like them, that speaks like them, or they speak their language, that already been through the, they know the ropes on how to get there and how to do things, and they can provide jobs, they can provide tips, information that they don't have, and that is quite an asset. So yes, it's extremely important. And they usually come to this country already with previous contacts and already with a connection.
How important is it to have the support of people sort of saying, well, that's great, you know, give this a try, you want to do more for your family, whatever it may be. Is it important when you make that step to feel that when you've left your native land that people are really pulling for you, they want you to succeed?
There is an attachment relationship there, and you want to be supported, you want to have anything that helps you, because it's a huge psychological hurdle that you have to go through, let alone all the rest of the physical hurdles that you have to go through. So you need to have the support. However, we see many immigrants that decide to leave as a rejection of everything they know. And that can be wonderful for them because it really releases the baggage of family traditions and family pressure and family roles. And it allows you to be who you want without the gaze of your parents or without the gaze of the family.
Sandra Mottauer is primary supervisor at the Center for Multicultural Training at Boston Medical Center. Tatiana Mutu's husband won a green card lottery, and they moved from Moldova to Arizona. She was a school teacher with a doctoral degree in Moldova and now works as a beautician in the Valley. So, Tatiana, how supportive were your friends and family, and was anybody negative about the move that you and your husband decided to make?
Yeah, so it was hard to do this separation from our parents and friends back there because, you know, of course, they miss us, and I have kids, which my parents miss as well. They did not judge. My mom just said, if you're going to be happy there, I'll be happy for you.
Did you feel like this was something you needed? Did you need to make a drastic change in your life?
You know, at that point when I was back home, I didn't feel like, oh, I want to leave, I want to go, because we were okay, young family with two babies, and we were like working our way. But when this opportunity came, we had a very hard decision. Like, we fought long what to do. And thinking that if we will denied, we will not have it anymore again. Because if you denied the application for the green card, you'll not have another chance. Mm-hmm. So we fought to try. And if we don't like it, we're just going to come back.
What have been the easiest adjustments and what have been the hardest adjustments?
Oh, my God. The hardest adjustment was first year and more about our social life and communication. But we were lucky because we had some relatives here from my husband part of family. We got very good friends in time. But the most hard thing, it was kind of like first, second year when you're missing your culture, your family, your parents, you know, especially for holidays. That was the hardest thing. But, you know, to make it easier, what I did, I just went home after 10 months. I just flew back with my kids, and I saw that Moldova was the country that I love, but I don't want to live there anymore. Our place is here, and because, you know, you have more conditions, you have more opportunities where you can develop.
When you are a doctor, in essence, as you were, and then you become a stylist, was that okay for your family, or did that take some explaining?
Of course it took some explaining, because everybody did not expect that I will do that. But it took me probably half a year to decide what I want to do with my career, because I was, first when I moved here, I was thinking medical field, teaching. I tried a little bit teaching in a daycare, so that was enough for me to know that I'll not be good. It's just a different culture, you know. It's such a different system and technology and parents and students thinking that I thought I will not be able to adjust and I will not have so much patience. Just because of the values which I had in myself from where I come from. So I thought I need something easier. I don't regret it. And I'm happy with what I'm doing now.
The adjustment can be really dramatic for an adult, but they do say for kids it can be a lot easier. Are you hoping for that for your kids? Are you hoping that your kids define themselves as Americans as opposed to being from Moldova?
I don't want them to be like straight Americans, you know?
Okay.
I still want them to keep our traditions. I still want them to know our language, which is Romanian, and I still want them to have those values that we had and we grow with. They're so different than here. And I'm not saying that this is bad or that is good. Mm-hmm. It's just so different, and we're very attached to what we grow with. And I want them to feel that the same way, but it's hard.
Tatiana Mutu of the Valley, originally from Moldova. We've been talking about the challenging adjustments immigrants coming to the U.S. have to make. Today, we continue our celebration of the working life. We're looking at the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. We're thinking about the jobs around the Valley that might not be what you expect. Today, it's the critters and crawlers as we step into a day on the job of pest control.
Hi, my name is Jerry Kramer. I'm a lead seal technician with Kaiko Pest Prevention. And what we do is go around and scorpion-proof homes, seal up entry points where it's visible that, you know, scorpions and different pests can get into. So what I'm doing is going through with the silicone caulking and, you know, sealing up the foundation and cracks and crevices. This is a primary area in which pests can enter in. Sometimes you have to dig out areas where the gravel's been, you know, pushed up against the house. It's definitely not one of the cleanest jobs that I've done, but I like challenges, you know, even though these bushes are, you know, you leave and you're cut up and stuff like that, but it's you know, there's a challenge. It's something every day. On an average size house, they're a two-person job. Our backpack sprayer that we use that contains chemical, it's about 40 pounds, 45 pounds when it's full of solution. You know, anything will get up any under anything it can, whether it's river rocks, you know, around trees. We spray the base of trees in order to create as many borders as we can. Generally, you know, with temperatures start to reaching above 70 degrees, that's when scorpions become active. One of the craziest things I've encountered during home seals would be coming across some rattlesnakes and different wildlife. I've come across, you know, while sealing foundation, sat up and realized there was a bobcat in the driveway across the street. So that's a little nerve-wracking at first, but it's not too common for me to come across scorpions. I've always considered myself a hard worker. Always took pride in no matter what job or title I had. It's showing whoever you're working with or whatever company you work for that you're going to do what you can to uphold that quality and that service that they want to provide.
That's Jerry Kramer working in the North Valley. We'll have more about somebody's job next Monday. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. When a new invention comes around, older ideas and tools tend to fade away. Think about how email replaced fax machines and the Model T replaced Mr. Ed. For almost 200 years, sign language has been an important communication tool for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. But now technology like cochlear implants gives many children the ability to hear and use spoken language from the time they're babies. From our partners at The Pulse at WHYY, Elizabeth Fiedler looks at how that may change the role of sign language and why some people really want to preserve this unique form of communication.
When the world gets too loud because of fireworks, or just to take a quiet break on the weekends, Sophie knows what to do.
When it's really loud, I just take the magnet off.
Sophie's 8. She's deaf and has a cochlear implant that's helped her hear since she was 1. But she knows by moving that magnet, she can stop the device from bringing her sound.
We didn't ever want our daughter to think that she's broken or, you know, not complete somehow.
Her mom, Samantha Zwislak, is sitting on the couch in their living room next to Sophie. She says getting her daughter a cochlear implant, which requires surgery, was a difficult decision.
We wanted to make sure that she knew, you know, we're not trying to fix something on you to make you be a particular way. But at the same time, there is this really neat technology that if you're the appropriate candidate and if you do it soon enough, children who are deaf have access to sound and can use their voice if they choose to speak.
Sophie can hear now and make her own decisions about how to communicate. Even though her parents signed to her, Sophie responds to them in spoken English. When her mom asks why, Sophie explains that they can hear, so she wants to speak. Zwislak says she wants her daughter, who attends the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf, to have the power to define her own identity.
Ultimately, at the end of the day, that child's going to grow up regardless, and they're going to find out who they are. And it might be hearing, it might be deaf. And we have chosen to accept that, you know, Sophie very well, she already identifies as being deaf, and we're comfortable with that. She's looking forward to going to the Deaf University. She wants to go to Gallaudet. We're very proud of that.
Other children who are deaf or hard of hearing are on a different educational path, where sign language is much less visible. Some attend one of the Clark Schools for Hearing and Speech, which has 5 locations across the country. All the children there use amplification to access sound, including cochlear implants and hearing aids. Clark School teaches listening and spoken language, but not sign language. Instead, they learn to listen and speak, with the goal of succeeding in mainstream classrooms alongside their typically hearing peers.
We've always raised Teddy the same way that we have with all of our children.
Caroline Linz's 7-year-old son, Teddy, was born deaf and uses cochlear implants. He doesn't know sign language, neither does his family. At 6, he started mainstream schooling after going to the Clark School.
Sign language is a beautiful language. You know, it just for our family, we felt that the listening and spoken language was what we wanted for our child. And the communication that we have in our family is spoken language. It's not sign language. And for us, we felt that that bond and that communication was important.
She thinks often about how his life would be different if he'd been born 10, 20 years ago. And she thinks about the role technology plays in his life now.
In addition to his cochlear implant, he has an FM system, which he uses at school, which is a way for the teacher to speak directly into his implant. So it blocks out all the peripheral sounds.
That helps him focus, even if another kid's making noise or somebody moves their chair with a loud squeak. There are promises on the tech horizon, even smaller, less visible technology. Still, some in the deaf community emphasize the importance of sign language. Sign language is Ron Burdett's primary means of communication. He does not have a cochlear implant and says sign language is part of his identity.
I'm very proud of deaf culture, deaf history. My parents are deaf. The day that I was born, we immediately started to communicate without any type of struggle.
Burdett's speaking through interpreter Brad Holt. He believes American Sign Language, ASL, helps build identity and self-esteem for children who are deaf.
You can communicate a variety of topics, mathematics, science, history, art, culture. There's no limitation to what you can communicate about in sign language. And parents nowadays have actually realized that sign language is a real independent language that comes with its own culture. So I don't think ASL will decline as technology improves.
He believes things like FaceTime and the prevalence of video can help people learn sign language. Other technology supports the use of sign language, like gloves that translate sign language into text and speech. One of the University of Washington students who created them said they're lightweight and ergonomic enough to use every day, similar to hearing aids or contact lenses. Back in Sophie's living room, the 8-year-old is talking about TV.
Tell me about the person who was on Dancing with the Stars.
He was on Dancing with the Stars and he's deaf, and he was the only deaf person who was dancing with the stars. Mm-hmm. And I think it was cool.
Before reporting this story, I have to say, I'd never heard of Niall DeMarco. He's deaf and has become a role model for lots of kids since appearing on Dancing with the Stars. DeMarco advocates for deaf children to get greater access to sign language, and he doesn't have cochlear implants. As I learned from just about everyone I interviewed for this story, he's a big deal to a lot of people in the deaf community. A minute into an energetic dance routine that's modeled on the movement of Spanish bullfighting, the show's producers cut the music. And DeMarco keeps dancing. Viewers get to imagine how challenging it is for DeMarco to dance. Until we feel all right. For Sophie and other kids, role models like DeMarco show the abundance of choices that exist for people who are deaf.
That's Elizabeth Fiedler from our partners at The Pulse. It's a health and science show, and the podcast is on iTunes. The Arizona State Schools for the Deaf and Blind will be getting a new superintendent this summer. Annette Reichman will take over the century-old institution, which has more than 2,000 students. She's the first superintendent to be deaf and also have limited vision. Nearly 5 years ago, she got cochlear implants to improve her hearing, but still considers herself to be a member of the deaf community. Growing up in a rural area with limited resources, Reichman struggled with bullying in traditional public schools, but blossomed in high school when she started attending the Nebraska School for the Visually Handicapped. Annette Reichman joins me to talk about her life and the changes she has seen in educating deaf and blind students. Annette, how did your vision and the hearing challenges affect your education as a young person?
Before I turned six, my parents knew I wasn't responding in the way that I should, and so there were extended family members that thought perhaps I was mentally retarded, but my parents knew that I was not. They just didn't know what was happening. They actually held me back from going to school. I didn't go to school at the age of five. I went to school at the age of six. My mother taught me how to read and write at home. So when we talk about expectations here, my mother had very high expectations for me. She taught me the beginning reading skills at the age of five at home. And for the next 5 years, she tutored me at home. I went to the regular public school in the nearest town at the age of six and was educated in the nearby town public school, the general education classroom in elementary school and junior high school.
As you were going through these things, did you feel, even with the support of your mother, did you feel lonesome? Did you feel like this is going to be really hard? Or were you able to focus on what might be great goals down the road?
Both, actually. By the time, talking about that local public school, by the time I was about the age of 10, both my classmates and I began to figure out that there was something a little bit different about how I interacted with them. I miss a lot in the class. I miss a lot on the playground. I was a pretty good lip reader, but I still sometimes didn't respond to whatever it was that was happening in an appropriate manner because I missed what was going on. So I began to experience some significant bullying by the time I got into 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. That social isolation, that sense of I didn't fit into the peer group, had a devastating effect on me. So much so that by the time I was in high school at the age of 16, I was ready to quit school. It just happened around that time, after my freshman year of high school, that a representative from the Nebraska School for the Visually Handicapped stopped by the farm and offered the opportunity to go to a residential program 300 miles to the east. And because I didn't have any other resources, and my parents didn't have resources, I made the choice to go to a residential program for students who are blind and visually impaired. It was the best thing that could have happened to me because there I got peers. I had a social group to interact with. I got involved with athletics. I was able to do a number of different things that I wouldn't have been able to do in the public school.
I want to know if you could talk a little bit about the past decade or two and what has changed in education for those who are hard of hearing or have vision loss. What are some advances that have been made that you think have been especially impactful?
We really have gotten to the place where we believe that students who are hard of hearing and deaf and students who are blind and visually impaired
can do just as well academically as their peers can. The second thing is technology. As technology continues to change rapidly, there are a lot more resources and technology that provides information, access to the environment for students who are blind and students who are visually impaired. For example, a lot of video clips and televisions and YouTube have captioning. So it's much more accessible for someone like me who can watch a movie and watch it with captioning and know every word that's being said because I can read it at the bottom of the screen. Right now, in speaking with you, I have a third party online. It's a video relay interpreter, a sign language interpreter that's on the video screen. She's listening in, and while I'm speaking with you directly, you're hearing my voice, she is signing to me when you speak to me. So again, that access to be able to have this exchange with you would not have been available even 10 years ago.
Well, now, Annette, I feel more pressure to ask better questions if I know there's someone else on the line, too. That's a lot of pressure. Annette Reichman is the new superintendent of the Arizona State Schools for the Deaf and Blind. She'll assume the position in late July. And, Annette, a great pleasure for me to talk with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Postpartum depression is vastly underdiagnosed, and a new study on the disorder concludes women are not being screened often enough or at all for the disorder. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center found that women should be screened for postpartum depression several times at the end of their pregnancy and throughout the first year after giving birth. And the show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on this. Lauren, first, can you tell us why is postpartum depression so underdiagnosed?
Well, there seems to be a lot that goes into that, from social stigma surrounding mental illness to the pressures put on a woman when she's having a baby. I talked to Dr. Erin Smith about this. She's a senior resident at the Western Psychiatric Institute and Clinic at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and she's one of the authors of the study. And she says she wanted to look at this issue because it's not talked about enough.
I just was seeing so many women with postpartum depression, and depression during pregnancy, which, you know, makes sense because it's among the most common complications of pregnancy. Very, very common, between 10 and 15% of all women will have a new episode of depression, either during pregnancy or the initial year postpartum.
So they looked at all of the research on postpartum depression, from the ways women are screened to when and where they're screened, and they determined that we need more screening more often, and it can be done in just about any situation, including at a pediatrician's office when moms are going in to get their babies checked up.
So they're saying women should be screened for this much more often. What does the screening process look like?
The most widely used screening tool is a sort of questionnaire. It's called the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale.
So it's a sheet of paper that says, you know, in the last 7 days, and then it has 10 statements. So, you know, have you been able to enjoy things as much as usual, or, you know, have you been feeling sad? And it goes through what the main symptoms of depression are. And I think that they do wonders for decreasing stigma, for kind of normalizing that, hey, this is just like your blood pressure or your heart rate. You know, I think about postpartum depression the same way that I would discuss diabetes or high blood pressure. It can happen, and it's treated, and people get better.
So removing the stigma is important during screening, but what about treatment? What are the best ways to do that?
So treatment looks different for different women, Smith says. It can be anything from some kind of talk therapy to, in more severe cases, medication and therapy as a combination. I wanted to know more about how women cope with postpartum depression, so I got a hold of Melissa Beauchamp. She's a nurse and the community education coordinator for Dignity Health Chandler Regional Medical Center and Mercy Gilbert Medical Center, and she runs a support group for pregnancy and postpartum that meets every week in Gilbert.
We talk in support group frequently about the butterflies and rainbows that people think is going to happen when you have a baby, and then the reality that there are no butterflies and there are no rainbows and there's a lot of hard work. And that's not that babies aren't worth it. I don't mean it that way. But there's a lot of work and there's a lot of broken up sleep. And that's if your life is perfect, you know, that's not even throwing hormone surges and stress and everything else in it.
Do the women that you work with in these support groups feel a lot of guilt?
Yeah. I think women in general are taught to multitask, or that they should multitask. And so if you can't do everything well, then there's a problem with you. Not there's a problem of asking yourself to do too much, not that this is unrealistic, but more there's a problem with you.
How do you work with women to help them get through that?
The wonderful thing about support group is so often a mom will come in and she'll be upset and she'll be in tears, but the other moms who are able to have been there a little while, you know, they rally around, they help support that woman too. You know, this country has a big bugaboo about mental illness, and people frequently don't think it is an illness or a problem. So they're scared to even show up at support group. And when they show up at support group, they're convinced they're the only woman with this feeling, and, you know, they're really a bad woman. And so many, many times we hear, I'm not the only one. You know, that alone is huge. It's not going to fix it. It's not going to make it go away. But the fact that you're not the only woman on the face of the earth with these kind of feelings is a huge relief to them.
So do you think it's important that women know that this is something that can be treated?
Yes. I mean, if I could get two bullet points out to the world, is one is this is real, and number two, this isn't going to be all your life. You know, there is help, and you're going to get better, but it's going to take some help. You're going to need to do a few things.
And that was the show's Lauren Gilger speaking with Melissa Beauchamp. She runs a support group for pregnancy and postpartum at Mercy Gilbert Medical Center. And Lauren, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
It's the show. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Phil Latzman.
The Pac-12 Conference holds its annual conference this week. Its dozen members will discuss issues such as TV rights, student-athlete welfare, and head trauma initiatives. But as the conference lost its regional identity, and how do collegiate athletics fit into the greater sports landscape out west?
Well, 5 years later, have the additions of Utah and Colorado made the conference stronger, or has the Pac-12 lost its identity? And after 40 years in the Pac-12, how do the Arizona teams fit in here in the year 2016? And by the way, why is the commissioner of the conference making $4 million a year? Those are the questions we're going to pose to our next guest, John Wilner, who writes about the Pac-12 conference for the San Jose Mercury News. So, John, we'll start with the fact that there's been so many collegiate programs that have changed conferences in recent years. It's really hard to keep track. I mean, you think to yourself, where do these teams play? What conference? The Pac-12, for instance, seems to be moving further and further away from the Pacific. Is there a danger of losing geographic identity?
I think that's certainly part of it. You know, West Virginia's in the Big 12. Maryland and Rutgers are in the Big 10. Missouri's in the SEC, and Colorado's in the Pac-12. Those are certainly some examples of it maybe not fitting geographically the way it did in the past or the way it should. I think the Pac-12 has probably got it right more than anybody else in terms of the schools that it has, not only geographically but culturally. I mean, Boulder, Colorado is far more akin to the Pac-12 ethos than it is to the culture of the schools in the Big 12, for instance. I mean, Colorado should be in the Pac-12.
So what are the biggest issues facing the Pac-12? And I'll just bring up one of them, and that is exposure and television rights. And there are some places where you can't watch the games. I think DirecTV comes to mind. But are television rights number one on that list of things that the Pac-12 has to worry about these days?
Well, it depends on who you ask. You know, because for some folks, the people who are running the athletic departments, money is a big, big, big deal, the biggest deal. And the league has some issues there. If you ask fans, being able to see their teams play is the biggest issue, and the league has problems on that front as well. The league is in probably better shape than it was 8 or 10 years ago relative to its competitors, but there are certainly issues.
Well, I think one of those issues that you've certainly written about and has been talked about is Is the salary of the commissioner of the Pac-12, Larry Scott, $4 million a year? That seems like a lot of money, but is he worth it?
You know, depends on who you ask. He's the highest paid commissioner. There are others in the $3 to $3.5 million range. I would say it was easier to justify that he was worth his salary 5 years ago when the league was overhauling itself and they were expanding and they were breaking into divisions and he was launching a conference network and negotiating a $3 billion deal with ESPN and Fox. You know, then you could say, all right, he's the highest paid commissioner in the country. He's doing a lot of stuff. The last, say, 2-3 years has basically been he's been more in maintenance modes, and it's a little bit harder, I think, for some people to accept that salary when they're not seeing major changes. People need to remember, Larry Scott runs the Pac-12 like a pro league.
Now, John, for those of us in Arizona, how do ASU and UA fit into the Pac-12's future plans and their markets? You know, do they sort of get lost out here?
Look, face it, the Pac-12 at its heart, the Pac-12 is the four California schools, and at even to a greater extent, the two LA schools. That is basically the core, and the Arizona schools, the Oregon, the Washington schools, they all fit in. They fit in for decades and in some cases for a century, but it is essentially a California-based conference, and those four schools, you know, because of the LA market, because of the success that UCLA basketball and USC football have had over the decades, because of the academic reputations of the Bay Area schools and where they are in terms of the Silicon Valley, you know, that's the heart of it. And it's not a slight to Arizona or Washington or Oregon schools, but that's the heart of it. And I think Utah and Colorado will eventually reach that level. It's going to take a few decades, but I mean, I certainly feel like the Arizona schools fit in just fine.
John Wilner writes about the Pac-12 conference for the San Jose Mercury News. John, thanks very much for your time.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.